ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's the Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. Listening to the Polish pianist Piotr Andrzejewski playing Bach's keyboard partita number one. That's the Preludium. Piotr Andrzejewski is back in Australia and he's back on the Music Show in the second half of today's programme, talking about the music of Bach, among other things. But first, another great virtuoso of his instrument and another longtime friend of the show. Martin Hayes is one of the most celebrated fiddle players around, very influential figure in traditional Irish music. He comes from the musical tradition of East County Clare and he interprets it in a wider contemporary context. He's collaborated with all sorts of people, classical, folk, contemporary artists, Paul Simon, Yo-Yo Ma, it's a long list. We'll talk to him in a moment. First, though, here's Martin with the Common Ground Ensemble.
Thank you.
That's the Boyne Water. We heard Martin Hayes with the Common Ground Ensemble. And it's a real pleasure to welcome back to the music show after many, many years, somebody who was almost a regular on the programme, Martin Hayes. How are you doing, Martin?
Oh, I'm doing very good, and good to talk with you again. It's been a long time, but we go back a bit, I think. Back to almost 1995.
That's when I first started doing this show, and I think you were probably on that first year with Dennis Cahill, who has since died, but you and Dennis were regulars on the program.
Yes, we did. Well, I think every time we came to Australia, we did your program.
Yeah, I think so. You're coming, in fact, with Kyle Sanner, who we've just heard as a member of the Common Ground Ensemble. Can you say something about working with the guitar? You obviously find it a very simpatico musical duo sound.
Yeah, I do. I mean, it does all the things the fiddle doesn't do. Like it's a rhythm instrument with harmonic possibilities, and it's nimble and transportable and fast, and I like guitar. I've been listening to guitar all my life and love certain guitar players, and Kyle is a very unique guitarist, and just like Dennis was unique, and they're not like each other, but I would definitely say they're unique.
Do you find you play differently then if you've got a different kind of guitarist?
You do. You play differently with every musician, and that is really the beauty of it, you know. I mean, I want to play with people that are going to make me see things differently, are going to make me feel things differently. And, you know, I want to be impacted by them. I don't want them just trotting alongside me, you know.
So an ensemble like Common Ground, for instance, there where you've got quite a rich palette of different colours, what does that bring out of you, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's a dialogue of five people, you know, which is obviously different than a duet, and it's going to impact things in different ways. But but there's a very rich supply of ideas and information being fed into the system at any one time. So, you know, the input of all of these musicians is like quite exciting for me to play with, you know. And, you know, I introduced all of them to each other, basically. And I kind of, you know, made basic arrangements for the band, you know, like I kind of sculpted out kind of like general sense of harmony and rhythm and what I wanted to do with tunes, you know. But then I put that in the conversation, and I don't block anybody from bringing any thought they have to it. And then there are moments in the arrangement of a band like this where I watch the cellist, you know, talking with the piano player, and I watch Kyle working with, you know, maybe Cormac McCarthy, and I see them, you know, exchanging ideas. I hear them like developing ideas. And I love that. I mean, that's what creativity is. That's what, you know, it's very exciting, you know. Now, not everything doesn't work, but certain amount of things do for sure, you know.
Yes. When I listen to your playing, I often find that I'm not thinking about the fiddle at all. I'm thinking about the music. I hear past your instrument into the music that you're playing. And I wonder whether that's something that you... I mean, you're not a... this is a compliment. You're not a flashy player.
I'm delighted you said this, because, like, I don't actually... Like, you know, I'm not obsessed with the fiddle, per se. And I'm obsessed with the melodies, that's for sure. And many times I find that it's what I don't do, you know, that actually allows the melody to come out sometimes, you know, that like if I make it about my playing, I actually get in the way of something that's actually quite fundamental, you know, which is the piece of music itself. And so I do whatever I think helps it. I don't add things that I don't feel, you know, enhance the musical picture overall, you know, like, but, you know, so sometimes like I listen to my own recording, I go, you're playing very simple stuff, but it's okay. You know, that's okay, you know.
And arguably, it's the hardest stuff to play, the simple stuff.
Oh yeah, well, there's always more to simplicity than appears at first, you know. But it like for me, it's like the clarity of the melodic idea. Like I might not spend a lot of time with ornaments, but the phrase, the way in which the phrase of melody flows, would take a lot of my attention. You know, I would put a lot of effort in there. It doesn't show up on the front as like dexterous or flashy or anything like that. So a lot of the work becomes invisible. But that's the nature of it. I'm used to that idea. And if a piece of music can sound beautiful, then I'm happy. You know, that's it.
Is that also the nature of the Clare style of fiddling, which is something we've talked about before, but not this decade?
Yeah. Well, to some degree, I suppose. I mean, like one thing I did learn from the older players that I spent time around with, people like Junior Crehan and Martin Rochford and stuff like that, was that they adored the melody and the subtleties of the melody. And they kind of had no interest in flashy pyrotechnics at all. So I kind of grew up with that kind of understanding of the tradition in the first place, you know. So it's not something I discovered, you know. I kind of saw it like that, like from early on. So the idea has often been to, you know, like the boiling water there. Like, I'm not doing anything there, really. I mean, all the work happened initially in terms of like kind of picking the tempo, like hearing the structure of the phrases, and just kind of going da 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 dee dee idle dee dun da. You know, I just really like getting to the point that I could hear the melody in that way, and then just literally playing it, you know, like without getting in the way of that, you know.
So what does the Clare style consist of, Martin?
Well, there's like in among the old players, and I mean we are definitely making generalizations here, because like it's not like everybody in Clare played the same way, they didn't really, but there was a tendency not to play very flashy and fast, was not a priority. Like, I could say that for sure. And I could say that feelings of kind of wistful, melancholic, joyful, melancholic, if that makes any sense to you, were kind of inherent qualities of the music. You know, there was a search for soulfulness within the music was a common sense among the old players that I knew, among the better of them for sure, that there was deep feeling in the music, and that's what they were wishing to bring out, you know. So in some cases one could generalize and say that we played a little more slowly, a little more delicately, a little less flashy, you know.
Are you able to show us what you mean?
Yeah, for example, like when the Bothy Band made their first album, there was a tune called The Morning Star on it, and it used to go like this. So, but I recorded that tune then, and it was influenced by the West Clare fiddler Patrick Kelly, and it used to go like this. So in a way, it is quite different, you know.
And you've got the portamentos there, the little slide ups.
Yeah.
Which you, I mean, you wouldn't hear them at the Bothy Band's tempo anyway.
Yeah, that's true. I'm just suggesting that tune because It just shows like that the general sense of that tune in the country at that time was that kind of like stronger, faster, more driving version of it. And the old West Clare way of playing that tune was quite melancholic and relaxed and slow and easy. And the notes were, you know, sliding around quite a bit. But it was almost related to like the old Shannon singing, you know, you're kind of like running notes into each other and kind of thinking of it less as dotted and more as kind of blurred, you know.
Yes, yes. On today's music show, I'm talking to Martin Hayes, Irish fiddler. Can we talk about tradition? What that word means to you? Does it mean the same thing that it used to mean? Does it shift a bit?
Yeah, I mean, like when you're playing music in a tradition, there's a kind of maybe an extra responsibility you have. You know, there's a responsibility to yourself to be authentic. There's a responsibility for music to be genuine and real. But then there's a kind of a responsibility to uphold the values of a tradition and to make sure that they're intact when you're finished with them, you know. So it becomes an extra layer of thinking, you know, when you're putting music together. But for me, I also, like, there's a sense, an implicit sense in tradition of it being sometimes static, of it being something of the past, and that one has to go back and replicate the past all the time. But I know that if when you go back to the past, you will see that there was a past before that past and another past. So tradition is also an evolving process and a continuing process, and a process that always, like in the case of this music, is always seeking to find meaning and place and relevance in its society, in its culture, in its time. So it needs to be able to be relevant right now as well. So, and it needs to be open, and it needs to be flexible, and it needs to be able to adapt and change. So, so the question of tradition for me is a question of what can change, what can adapt, and what is like something that cannot possibly be disturbed. And in my sense and understanding of that, it's the old melodies, and the beauty of them should not be destroyed. They can be played with, they can be experimented with, but the true DNA of the music is the melody itself. So the tradition for me is very much about the melody, not so much about how everybody else played or how it was done or how it wasn't done. I see a lot of flexibility and openness in all of that.
Because you've been talking to me on and off for 30 years, that means you're now an elder in this tradition, and I wonder whether that brings certain responsibilities.
Well, yeah, it's funny, yeah. Yeah, there was like, I used to do interviews and things, and I would often see this, the young fiddle player, Martin Hayes, the young, like that stopped a long time ago. But, and so, yeah, you kind of move into a slightly different category. But in truth, my mind hasn't changed. I'm still searching and looking, and I'm still imagining music on into the future, kind of as I always have. Maybe other people's view of me and where I sit in the tradition as a result of being around so long may change. I mean, there are 20-year-olds out there playing now who, you know, like had, like, you know, weren't born when I was doing interviews with you, you know. So I probably seem quite old to them, but I feel like I'm still getting started sometimes, you know.
Yes, that's important, is it?
Yeah, that's. I feel like I'm still trying to crack this thing, you know?
Yeah, me too. Yeah. What about the different kinds of techniques? I mean, you collaborate with lots of different kinds of fiddle players, some of whom think of themselves as violinists.
Yes.
And you don't all play in the same way. I wonder how that works if you're playing with, you know, if you're playing with Brooklyn Ryder, say, or you're playing with the cellist Yo-Yo Ma.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you see, it's, like once upon a time, like the lines of demarcation between these genres, between classical music, like quote unquote the high arts, or jazz or avant-garde music or anything like that. We lived in silos, the impermeable, like we just didn't communicate. But now the world has changed and we do communicate, and we do seek to understand each other. And I do a lot of collaborating across genres, across cultures, without feeling like I'm particularly skilled at doing that. I don't think I have the background necessary for it. But still, I go and do it anywhere. You know, so I'm used to doing what I think I can't do sometimes. And I found in my collaborations that the dialogue, the human conversation of understanding, like when I collaborate with a classical musician, there would be a tendency at first thought, you might think, okay, I should simplify this here. I should water it down here, because if I go all the way into the depth of this tradition, we won't find the communication. But I found that it was quite the opposite, actually, that the deeper I could go into this and the deeper I could express this music, the more common ground we could actually find. You know, like if you meet a really good musician from any genre of music and you are actually able to bring your music out of its technical silo and bring it to a place of expression and feeling, and if that is expression and feeling is tangible and understandable and something that any human being can feel, then you have actually done the most important communication with that other musician, because now they understand the music from a world of feeling, which allows them to, you know, employ what they know that connects with that same kind of feeling and how they can relate to that. I know this sounds very weird and abstract and a little bit kind of whooshy, but it is kind of like that. It's really meeting in the more abstract space of the feeling of music, you know?
Well, yeah, I do know. And classical musicians have been drawing on traditional music for hundreds of years.
Yes.
So I can see what Brooklyn Rider, the string quartet, get from working with you. What do you get from working with them?
Well, I get the joy of sitting on a stage with these incredible musicians making all these incredible sounds all around me. And like, it's just like immensely enjoyable, and hearing what they hear, really. Like, for example, when I did that album with Brooklyn Rider, I mean, I literally went to Brooklyn, you know, and I'm sitting there, and this is before the album, we started figuring out what to do. They were sending out messages to different composers, young composers around Brooklyn, saying, hey, here's a tune, and Martin just did a tape recording of it. What do you want to do with this? Would you like to try something like this? So there were three or four music arrangers, friends of theirs, just floating in and out of the apartment with different arrangements over a few days. One of them, incidentally, was Kyle Sana, the guitarist that's going to be on tour with me. And that's where I first encountered his music, in a way. But yes, so like, I just left myself open to a lot of other people just making choices and like experimenting around the things I did. And for me, like, the challenge was to risk alienating my own audience and listeners, or to risk people in the tradition just like hating what I did, or to also enter a situation where I didn't have control, really. You know, I had to just allow it to play out and become whatever it was going to become, you know.
It's been very good to catch up. Thank you, Martin Hayes, for being my guest on The Music Show once again, and we really look forward to seeing you here in Australia with Kyle.
Andrew, it's great to chat with you. Thank you very much.
And we'll go out with the sound of Martin Hayes with Brooklyn Rider from their album of 2019. This is P. Joe's Reel. Thank you. P-Joe's Reel, that's Martin Hayes, and Brooklyn Rider. And Martin Hayes will be in Australia in February. He's performing in Perth, Castlemaine, Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane. And the details are on our website and also in the podcast notes. It's the music show that you're listening to on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. It's Oz Music Month. I haven't mentioned that. I should have mentioned it last week. It was Oz Music Month then too. And we've got time for some new Australian music. This is Stella Donnelly with Feel It Change. The Welsh-Australian singer-songwriter Stella Donnelly, Feel It Change, from her new album Love and Fortune. It's her first in 3 years. It's the music show. I'm Andrew Ford. Piotr Andrzejewski is a very fine pianist. He appears regularly in recital and in front of the most famous orchestras in the world, playing concertos. He's tended to concentrate on the German Viennese repertoire. And he's in Australia on tour at the moment, playing music by Brahms, Bach and Beethoven. He chooses his repertoire very carefully, and his words as well. He joined me on the music show last in 2001, when we had a great conversation about the Diabelli variations. On this occasion, we tracked him down in Japan just before he came on to Australia. We'll hear that conversation after we've heard him play the G-sharp minor prelude from the second book of The Well-Tempered Clavier by Bach. ¶¶ the prelude in G-sharp minor from the second book of Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, the pianist Piotr Andrzejewski. And ahead of his tour to Australia, he joins me from Japan. Welcome back to the show, Piotr.
Pleasure to be back.
Let us talk. Bach is central to this program. Literally, his music turns up between Brahms and Beethoven. Would you say his music is also central to classical and romantic piano music, full stop?
I think Bach is a unique phenomenon in classical music. You know, there was nothing like this before and nothing like this after. And he's not really somebody who invented the new style. He more or less summarized everything that happened before in music. And so it's, I'd say, yes, he's in the middle. I have the impression he's in the middle of what happened few centuries before and what will happen a few centuries later in music. Yeah?
But I'm thinking more in terms of his centrality, in terms of his influence, because I think one can hear Bach in Brahms and Beethoven, the other two composers in your program, but it's also there in Chopin. You've played a lot of Chopin and Schumann, and he seems to be a touchstone for composers who came after him, and in jazz for that matter.
Definitely, yes. I mean, you see, this music just contains so much, and I can't imagine being a composer born after Bach and not being somehow under the influence, yeah, in all possible different ways. So, yes, he's very central in that respect. Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's talk about him in the context of the Brahms pieces that you're playing. I must say, I hadn't thought of Bach as being an obvious influence on Brahms until I heard a recording made, I think, in the 1950s of the conductor Wilhelm Furtwängler,
yes,
conducting a Brandenburg Concerto No. 5 and also playing the harpsichord part, except he was playing the piano. And to hear him play that big solo, yeah, on the piano, it sounds like Brahms, the way he plays it. And the connection is suddenly very, very clear. So what do you hear of Bach in Brahms?
Well, with Brahms, I must say, besides the obvious, you know, interest in the fugue, like the Handel variations for piano or the Requiem or other pieces, I mean, in those late pieces, I must say, not that much. I mean, of course, his mastery of counterpoint. This is, I think, also something that Bach, I don't want to say imposed, but it was difficult to be a composer later in 18th, 19th century without really mastering counterpoint. And so obviously Brahms is a complete, absolute master of the counterpoint. But in these pieces, in terms of the character, I don't see that much connection with Bach.
What they have in common with the Bach pieces that you're playing on this program and the Beethoven too is that they're late. And I wonder whether you could say something about late Brahms and how it relates to what had gone before.
Well, those pieces are like a testament, you know, of his life, I have the impression. And at the end, I don't know, while I worked on these pieces, I tried to get to the essence of it and what really stands behind this testament. And in fact, we realize we know very little of him, and he's such a secretive man, and we know so little, and he hides so well. And I think that's what I wrote in my booklet of the CD. I mean, and one realizes this is where perhaps lays the beauty of this music, is that you want to guess, you have this urge to know what is behind these feelings which are not expressed to the end, which are all restrained. They are there, but this music is all about being restrained and secretive. And you have to go behind this several, you know, masks that he puts, yeah, on. But how does it relate to music he wrote before, yes? Or what happened in music before?
Yes.
I mean, obviously a Schumann connection there, you know, in terms of character pieces. I mean, in the end, they are character pieces. So I feel, yes, a strong connection to Schumann and to very basically saying to Romanticism, yeah, but somehow less to Bach. I mean, that's how I feel, but maybe somebody much more clever would prove me how much Bach there is there, yeah.
The program, as I said, that all of the music is late, and I don't know whether that was something that was part of your thinking in putting it together.
You mean late in the lives of the composers, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the late sonatas of Beethoven. I mean, in a way, Beethoven sort of invents the concept of lateness almost, doesn't he, in music?
Yes, yes. It's true, absolutely. I mean, we could say this with Mozart a bit. Obviously, there are some characteristics of late Mozart and possibly late Haydn. But with Bach, it's much more difficult. You are right. I mean, Beethoven invents pretty much, I don't want to say everything, but it's such an unprecedented revolution in music. I don't know how late is this prelude, and those preludes and fugues. I mean, obviously, they are not early pieces, but...
Well, they're 20 years after the first book, aren't they? They're from 1742.
Yes, but not all, you know, it's... Well, we are not that sure, you know. Some of them, they were written, I think, over a large span of time. And as far as I know, we are not completely sure when each prelude and fugue was written, you know. It's, let's say, the whole set is put together late.
Mm.
But some of the pieces are earlier than the first book, apparently.
Oh, really? Are they? So it's a later publication, but it's not necessarily compositions. Yes.
Not necessarily. Some of them, yes. And here, I'm not clever enough to tell you which one specifically. And I'm not sure we do know, actually. I'm not sure we have proof which pieces are really written in the 1740s and which are much written much earlier, maybe in the 20s already.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we know that the Beethoven A-flat sonata is a late piece. Yes. And it's a piece I kind of associate it with you because you recorded it years and years ago.
Even twice.
Yeah, and you're returning to it for this program. So perhaps we should talk about the middle one of the last three sonatas, which are often thought of as a group. It's, like all of them, it's a remarkable piece formally. And it's full of lyricism. I mean, that's a sort of hallmark, isn't it, of late Beethoven?
Yes, I mean, depends what you call lyricism. Yes, I mean, you know, the slow movement of the Hammerklavier is full of lyricism. There is always that element in Beethoven, but it's true in this sonata, maybe more than in the last one.
Yes, and he uses terms in these late sonatas like, you know, aria, for instance, so they're kind of songful terms. Perhaps you could tell us a little about the structure of this late A-flat sonata, Opus 110.
Well, it's, again, very original structure with a sonata allegro, with a sonata form, first movement, but not a proper allegro in terms of, you know, a very decisive, affirmative allegro. It's a rather cantabile, amabile allegro, as he writes. Then you have a short and very abrupt scherzo type, second movement, with a trio in the middle. And until then, the sonata would be pretty, I'd say, classical and nothing that unusual, and the real thing starts with the third movement. And how to even describe this formally, you know, it's a recitativo with an arioso and with a fugue, with a return of the arioso and with an inverted fugue at the end, yeah? And to me, it's almost like a oratorio type piece, yeah, this last movement, with a real sense of drama, almost scenic drama, I want to say, which is quite rare with Beethoven. It's not really the composer we associate with scenic drama like we would with Mozart, for example, yeah?
Charles Rosen writes about this in The Classical Style and talks about how it's an example of Beethoven using intellectual form for dramatic effect. But compared to a Bach fugue, which is a fugue, I mean, here, as you said, he interpolates his other stuff in the middle of it and then brings back the fugue theme, but upside down at the end. And so he's turning all sorts of musical and intellectual tricks, but the effect is of great musical drama.
But, you know, isn't a Bach fugue of a great musical drama in its own? if you take the fugue of the G sharp minor fugue, the double fugue, how the two themes, you know, it's a two subject fugue. First subject, second subject comes later, and then at the end he puts both subjects together. I mean, what a dramatic effect! Bach is full of drama. Bach fugues are full of drama. Some of those fugues of the second book, I mean, I've recorded. I mean, it's so depends what we understand by drama. Yeah? Yeah. So of course there is no arioso, there is no recitative in that sense. Of course, it's Bach fugue is a Bach fugue, but I less and less understand this intellectual concept in music. But when I was younger, I was very attracted to this. But I mean, all music is intellectual somewhere deep down, no? And,
yes.
And none of it really is. Yes, I mean the fugue, yes. I'd say it's more of a strict form, yeah, than intellectual. It's dealing with strictness, yes, because of course the fugue imposes a certain strictness. And of course there is much more strictness in a fugue than, let's say, in the last movement of the Schubert A major sonata, yeah?
Mm.
But intellectual, I don't know. I don't know what it means. I'm sorry.
No, and I may well have been putting words into Charles Rosen's mouth. He's not here to defend himself. Maybe he said strict. But let's finish perhaps by saying something about Romanticism, because I mentioned earlier Chopin and Schumann, which are two composers whose music you've played a lot.
Yes.
And when people talk about late Beethoven, they often talk about it in the context of the sort of burgeoning early Romanticism in music. Is there a through line there, do you think, from the last works of Beethoven in particular to composers, well, such as Schubert and Schumann and Robert Schumann?
Well, yes. I mean, again, Beethoven was such a, it sounds awful, but influencer today, it sounds really terrible. But you couldn't really do without him. Well, I would say there's one exception. It's Chopin. There's one exception, I think. Chopin really managed somehow not to be under his shadow. He found his completely own musical way, except in the third sonata, where people say he did study lots of Beethoven when he was writing the Opus 58, the third sonata. But Schumann, obviously. But you know, on the other hand, I played recently the Emperor Concerto, which is not really a late piece. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the slow movement, I can't help but I hear the Chopin E minor concerto, especially the second movement. I do. So I don't think late pieces of Beethoven are leading towards Romanticism. I think even earlier pieces, possibly even more. Yeah, I think in his late pieces, it's something else. You know, it's actually a return to strict forms. It's a return to Bach. It's a return to early 18th century. To the fugue. I mean, look at the fugue in late Beethoven. Whether it's the Grosse Fuge or the Kammerklavier or the Opus 110 or Quartet Opus 131, the fugue right at the beginning of the piece. Mm. Yeah, completely crazy, crazy. Missa Solemne is a monumental double fugue at the end of the credo. So does that lead to Romanticism? Not really, yeah. I think the Moonlight Sonata takes you more to Romanticism, or the second movement of the Emperor Concerto.
Yes,
or,
yes, the Pathétique.
You see what I mean? I think late Beethoven is, on one hand, going backwards to the old masters, and on the other hand, he goes towards the 20th century, jumping over Romanticism almost, yeah?
Yes, and I remember when you recorded that sonata for the first time, you followed it on the album with the Webern Variations, which was provocative thing to do, but it made a certain kind of sense.
You know, I've played a few years ago, I played recitals, and in the second half, I put Webern and Opus 110, one after each other, and I cannot tell you how it works. How fantastic it looks. There's such sense of unity.
What we're discovering is, again, the impossibility of putting the music into words, and that every word that one comes up with, for example, intellectual, there is the opposite is also true.
Well, that's what you want to learn more and more with age. It's so hard to put words into things, no? In music.
Yes.
Because, everything you say, you want to say the contrary.
Yeah. I agree. The questions are so much more interesting than answers as well, but the answers are in the music.
Hopefully. You know, I am not sure that the answers are in the music. I mean, the questions are more interesting in music as well. Do we get really answers? I mean, once in a while, thank God, but otherwise we'd be completely lost. But most of the time it's questions, 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 you know. And coming back to this Brahms, I'd like to say again, you know, this music is, to me, it's one big question, you know. What does he want to hide? Yeah. Hmm. And this intrigues me the most. And sometimes I find some kind of hint of something. Okay, he really wanted to say this to us here. I mean, it's really hidden behind 10 different masks. So one big question mark, Brahms, no?
Yes. Thank you very much, Piotr, for talking to me on the music show again. It's been a pleasure. And we are very much looking forward to hearing you play. And if not answers, then perhaps provisional answers.
Provisional answers and questions.
And, and some more questions. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
That's the end of Beethoven's Sonata in A-flat Major, Opus 110, played by Piotr Andrzejewski. And he is in Australia through November, starting next week on the 10th of November in Sydney. And he's giving a piano masterclass in Perth on the 14th of November. All of the details and dates are, as usual, on our website and in our podcast notes. Next time on the music show, throw down your guns, because Australian Crawl's Reckless is our cover story. Vanessa Hughes and John Encarnasau will be along to unpack the different versions.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.